Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on education when we come back. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper are things like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there is no difference in the value of a gold and silver coin and that of its counterpart in clad coin or currency. And that's very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of that gold over paper. And there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes due on that paper money over gold. Now, God and our founding fathers didn't give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that if they were ever going to subjugate a free people, they must first take away the people's gold and silver coin to take away the people's right to property and to destroy those property rights. So if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights, and that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. So let me teach you how to do just that. It's our business school, which is now on compact disc for adult home school. If you'd like more information about private business, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational. And best of all, it's free, and you can call right now to order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, and click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, education. Education's a big topic. Each and every one of us has an opinion about public school, private school, homeschool. If you're like I was educated in public school. And I'm still recovering from it, and I'm pushing 70. It takes a long time to recover from the institutionalization called public school. And public schools have problems, and David W. Kirkpatrick pointed out some of the problems attendant to public school. He puts out a newsletter every week from the U.S. Freedom Foundation, and you can probably get a copy if you'd like. It's www.freedomfoundation.us. He's a senior education fellow. He says that public educators' problems are not all their fault. And he begins by telling us that one problem with public policymakers is that they insist upon making public policy. Perhaps nowhere is this more of a problem than in public education. A recent study by Common Good of laws and regulations affecting a typical New York City high school is their latest example. Now, the study found that more than 60 sources of law and regulations, including thousands of provisions applying to a New York City high school. These include New York State's more than 800-page school law, 720 pages of regulations from the State Commissioner of Education, more than 15,000 decisions in 43 volumes of the Commissioner's Office, and 204-page teacher union contract with the district, and nearly 700-page No Child Left Behind Act, and more than 200 pages of regulations just concerning student discipline. So let me pause here, put my arrow in the margin, and make my editorial comment. Now, I added up those numbers alone, and they were 17,624, but if you'll notice, he said in the opening sentence of the paragraph, the study found more than 60 sources of law and regulations. These 60 sources of law and regulations include thousands of provisions applying to a New York City high school. I cited those that he cited out of those 60 sources, which is only five. There are 55 more sources. Now that means that there are more than 25,000 regulations, 25,000 pages of material that regulate a typical New York City high school. Well, I went upstairs to my library and I found that the Encyclopedia Britannica contains 22,800 pages. So to run a New York City high school takes more pages of material to regulate the students, their conduct, the teachers' union, the education, the firing of teachers, the discipline of students, and so on. It takes more pages of material than is contained in the Encyclopedia Britannica. 65 steps are involved in suspending a disruptive student. So if you had a disruptive student in your class and you wanted to expel the student from school, you have 65 steps to accomplish the goal. It has 83 steps in firing a teacher. So if you found that you were a principal in the public school and that you had an incompetent teacher, you have to go through 83 hoops to fire that teacher. There are 38 things that you have to do in filling a teacher vacancy, 99 things to do in replacing a heating system, another 99 in conducting an athletic event, including the size of the ear flaps, and 35 steps in suspending a special education student. Some of these procedures can take years to resolve, and even then, such an attempt to fire a school teacher may cost more than $100,000, and it still may not be successful. Nor is New York State alone, or at the top of the list in bureaucratic complexities. Indiana's school code at 1,250 pages a few years ago is more than 50% longer than New York's. Californians have more than 9,000 pages, and its 11 volumes are said to weigh more than 40 pounds. It includes such essential details as stipulating football uniforms be sterilized at least once a year. Districts may use armored vehicles to transport money to banks, and prohibiting parents from helping paint or clean public schools without union permission. It has been reported that Pennsylvania suburban school district superintendents must comply with 1,027 mandates, 70% of which are unfunded. A few years ago, when Ohio Governor George Voinovich said school administrators in that state spend as much as 50% of their time filling out federal forms, which account for only 6% of the education spending. The U.S. Department of Education itself has said its requirements result in 48.6 million hours of paperwork annually, the equivalent of 25,000 full-time teachers. Last year, it was said that journalist Eleanor Burkett estimated a typical school principal faces 470,000 federal, state, and local regulations. If her estimate is even remotely accurate, the result is a regulatory absurdity and administrative impossibility. No one could possibly even be aware of so many obligations. And furthermore, policymakers continually making policy means that at any given time, many, perhaps thousands of these regulations are in the process of being amended, deleted, added to, or otherwise changed. As someone once said about government in general, there are so many laws and regulations that all of us are continually breaking some without being aware that we're doing so or that they even exist. This is assuredly so of public school boards and public school staffs. And none of this even includes case law, the result of an ever-increasing volume of court decisions. All of which would be bad enough if such detail had a positive effect, but what the late James S. Coleman and his colleagues concluded 40 years ago is likely to be still true. In a 1966 report, they said they could not find any educational policy or strategy that ensured any student achievement. As former Xerox chairman David T. Kearns and Dennis P. Doyle wrote in their 1988 work, Winning the Brain Race, the truth is, they said, that prospective or prescriptive rules and regulations are necessarily only if there are no measurable performance objectives. Once there are performance standards, schools can be encouraged to do it their own way. Common Goods Chair Philip K. Howard has now echoed the sentiment, saying the priority should be educating children, not compliance. Let them use their own best judgment and then be held accountable for the results. This is the theory behind the charter school movement and should be more generally adopted. To paraphrase former President Ronald Reagan, in schooling, government is not the solution to the problem, he said. It is the problem. The basic problem with public education is that it takes in a government institution, and Joel Stein, after taking part in a principal for a day program in New York City, said it takes place in a governmental institution. I, too, was institutionalized, were you? Now, there's more to education than just all of the rules and regulations and laws of public education. There's something in the background. It's something that's called the right stuff. The right stuff, cited from an article in the New American back in 1994. The late Professor Medford Evans, former chief of security training for the Atomic Energy Commission and a Yale PhD, once said that of our government school system, he said, quote, never has so much been spent to teach so many so little. An increasing number of parents, disenchanted with the many pitfalls of statist education, are turning to non-government alternatives. And though the number of private schools appears to have stabilized over the past decade at about 25,000 schools and about 2.5 million students, it is estimated that homeschooling is surging at an annual rate of 20 to 40% per year. With nearly 1 million children now learning their ABCs and values from their parents in their home school during the school day, this flight from public schools has been accompanied by an expanding market for information and resources to enhance the teaching talents of both parents and private school educators. Now, there's some background materials that you should be aware of. And as a first step, it is essential to understand the cause of our present discontents. Education specialist Samuel Blumenfeld, in his important work called Is Public Education Necessary?, explains in disturbing detail how and why Americans were enticed into surrendering their educational freedom for educational statism. Blumenfeld notes that of the 117 men who signed the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, and our Constitution, only one-fourth of those men attended college. And George Washington was educated by his father. Benjamin Franklin was educated by his father in a private school. And Thomas Jefferson was educated by a tutor. Blumenfeld's NEA Trojan Horse in American Education exposes the leftist political activities and the radical social policies of the National Education Association, and documents the significant contribution which the nation's largest teachers' union has made to illiteracy, to crime and sexual promiscuity, drug abuse, and declining academic performance, all accomplished by the nation's largest teachers' union. Other works by Blumenfeld focus on solutions to the education debacle, including how to start your own school and why you need your own school, which helped launch the blossoming homeschool movement in America. The New Illiterates and How to Keep Your Child from Becoming One is a detailed guide to systematic phonics instruction on how to tutor, which explains how virtually any parent who can read can adequately teach the three R's to his own children. The Blumenfeld Education Letter, published monthly, keeps subscribers current on the pros and cons of educational trends. And then there's legal aid. Now, the obvious threat which private schools pose to the government system has resulted in many varied attempts by the government to snuff out or to gain control of the public school, or the private school and homeschool movement. Competent legal assistance for private and homeschoolers has therefore been an imperative. And the Virginia-based Homeschool Legal Defense Association was founded in 1983 to unite a large number of homeschool families so that each family could have a source of quality legal assistance at low cost. The nonprofit organization presently has approximately 30,000 family members. While most legal threats to its members are resolved amicably and out of court, when litigation becomes necessary, the association provides full representation at each stage of the legal proceedings without cost to the family. The HSLDA Senior Counsel is Christopher J. Klicka, who has successfully represented over 2,000 homeschool families in legal conflicts and is author of Homeschooling in the United States, a Legal Analysis, which describes in detail the legal atmosphere for homeschooling in each state. It is updated annually, and his most recent book, The Right Choice, The Incredible Failure of Public Education and the Rising Hope of Homeschooling, is a comprehensive overview of the benefits and biblical basis of homeschooling, its historical heritage, and its academic success. The HSLDA was a plaintiff in a recent case in which the Texas Supreme Court ruled unanimously on June 15, 1994, that a homeschool enjoys the same legal status as a private school in Texas, as long as it has a written curriculum and provides instruction in spelling, grammar, reading, math, and good citizenship. Here are a few other cases from the lengthy list in which the HSLDA has been involved. When two families in North Dakota were tried and convicted for the crime of homeschooling, the HSLDA appealed to the North Dakota Supreme Court, which ruled in favor of the families and reversed their truancy convictions. HSLDA filed a federal civil rights action on behalf of 9 homeschooling families against sundry school districts in Pennsylvania that had attempted to compel the parents to abide an oppressive tutorial provision of the state's compulsory attendance law. A U.S. District Court judge ruled that the provision was unconstitutionally vague and unenforceable, and as a result, more than 20 court cases against HSLDA member families were either won or were dismissed. In February of this year, the HSLDA was instrumental in triggering massive nationwide opposition to a dangerous amendment that had quietly been slipped into H.R. 6, the House bill, to reauthorize the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965. The amendment proposed by Liberal Representative George Miller, Democrat of California, would have effectively required state certification of all teachers, including homeschooling parents. The massive cascade of phone calls, telegrams, and letters persuaded the House to scrap the amendment on February 24th by a margin of 424-1. Only Representative Miller stood firm. Then, approved 374-53, an amendment offered by conservative Representative Dick Armey of Texas, stating that nothing contained in the rest of the act shall be construed to affect home schools. Both votes were shown on pages 66 and 67. Now, Alpha Omega Publications, headquartered in Tempe, Arizona, was established in 1982 by J. Richard Fugate, who is today its chief executive officer. Fugate is a longtime activist in the Christian school movement. Fugate earlier founded and served as principal of a private school, and in 1971 distributed and disturbed at the extent to which humanism and its attendant evils had permeated the curriculum of the government schools, which their children were attending, Fugate and his wife placed the youngsters in Christian schools. But those, Fugate recalls, were not any better. They used public school textbooks with the same kind of offending material in them, United Nations preaching and all that, so we started teaching our children at home. Alpha Omega supplies textbooks and other materials in the areas of language, the Bible, mathematics, and social science. Fugate explains that they were written by some 200 authors throughout the country, all with at least master's degrees and 5 years of teaching in their fields. At present, the company's texts are not used in government schools, but a recently published mathematics book could help shore up that subject in statist schools. While the number of private schools has leveled off in recent years, Fugate is encouraged by the substantial growth in committed homeschool families. The response to House Resolution 6, he believes, let the country see in a very dramatic way the level of commitment that has been apparent from within the movement for some time. He estimates that homeschooling is increasing by about 50% each year, but loses perhaps one half of those parents who start up the year before only to find the task is too trying. In speeches, he warns parents that if you lack self-discipline yourself, and if you lack personal organizational skills, and you lack the ability to control your own child, you're probably going to fail. As the movement continues to grow and mature, then parents become more knowledgeable and proficient at the start. The attrition rate will undoubtedly decline. Now, the inaccuracy and humanist bias of many textbooks used in government schools has been a scandal for decades. In 1961, 16-year-old Jim Gabler asked his dad to scrutinize troubling passages in his high school history text. Mel Gabler, too, was disturbed by what he read. From the text's enthusiastic support of constitutionally questionable federal programs to the omission of crucial aspects of U.S. history, the experience led Mel and his wife Norma to pursue and peruse other textbooks used by their children. They found so many outrageous examples of immorality, obscenity, socialism, and anti-Christian, anti-American bias that they decided to register a complaint with the Texas State Board of Education's Textbook Committee. Now, initially, they were viewed as mere troublemakers and cranks. But as the gabblers delved further into the matter and meticulously documented their case, they have compiled thousands of detailed textbook reviews, which run from a few to as many as 146 pages. Other concerned parents, educators, and the news media began taking them seriously, and as their tenacious influence grew, textbook publishers and the State Textbook Committee began heeding their pleas for more emphasis on basic academic skills and less space for immorality, profanity, and other objectionable material. Beginning in 1988, the gabblers began concentrating primarily on the factual errors in text rather than questions of philosophy or ideology, though they are more concerned about the latter. The fact-focused approach has made it more difficult for the textbook publishers and school officials to avoid making corrections, and has tended to convince an increasing number of print and electronic journalists that what they have been claiming all along is true. In the spring of 1991, they revealed a shocking number of factual errors in textbooks slated for state adoption. One Macmillan McGraw-Hill text claimed, for instance, that Sputnik was the first successful intercontinental ballistic missile launched by the Soviet Union and that it carried a nuclear warhead. Actually, it was a space satellite, SANS warhead, and a Scott Forsman and Company text claimed that the Korean War began in 1959 and that the United States easily settled the conflict by using the bomb. In fact, the war, or police action as it was euphemistically termed, began in 1950, was settled uneasily after 33,651 Americans were killed and another 103,000 injured and wounded, and the U.S. never nuked the enemy as implied. In the months after the gabblers began their search, publishers made nearly 8,000 changes in their texts. As reported in the New American for May 18, 1992, on December 16, 1991, the publishers resubmitted the texts along with signed affidavits guaranteeing that the books were error-free. But on January 9th, the gabblers submitted a list of another 187 factual errors that they and Dr. Neil Frey, a former history professor, had found in the corrected texts. The red-faced publishers made another 1,669 changes and returned with the new error-free versions. This time, the gabblers and Frey found an additional 112 factual errors. Mel Gabler laments that our nation has become exactly what it has been taught to our children. 33 years ago, when we started, we predicted the situation now. Not that we were smart. We just looked at what the children were being taught then. And one of the problems, he advises, is that nearly everybody that fights these problems, whether it's abortion or pornography, socialism or whatever the subject, they generally, if you even mention education, put it as one of the spokes on a wheel. Well, actually, education is the hub because your ACLU-type lawyers and your left-wing politicians, all of those people are all, to the man, victims of their public education. Yeah, we got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing education. Tonight's program is derived from the New American Magazine, August 8, 1994, What Went Wrong? You know, every year our public schools turn out millions of young adults who are totally unprepared for the task of living responsibly in a free society. And the most alarming news is it was planned that way. We'll get into public education and the planning of the deliberate dumbing down of America as we progress. But if you're one of those who's sitting on the sidelines saying, I know all of this is true and I really deplore the public schools, but I don't have any other choice, let me tell you that there are three choices in education, at least here in the United States. Choice number one is public school. And approximately 47 million American children are institutionalized in these public institutions every year. 47 million. The number is probably approaching 50 by now. Now there are approximately 2.5 million children that are educated in private schools in the country, about 25,000 private schools. So there's two choices. Every state in the union makes provision for public school and private school. There's a third choice that you have, which is called homeschool. Every state in the union provides for homeschooling by statute. Some states are more liberal than others, and some states are a little more rigorous, but you can educate your child at home, and your child does not need to be subjected to all of the debilitating processes that the public school offers. So keep that in mind. There are three choices. And, of course, when you send your child to public school, you have made your choice. And even if you send your child to public school because you're ignorant and don't know of the other choices that you have available to you, you have still made your choice. Now, one of the most comprehensive sources of information about homeschooling has been the Big Book series by Mary Pride, which, beginning in 1986 with publication of the Big Book of Home Learning, the complete guide to everything educational for you and your children, has cataloged and evaluated various homeschool curricula, textbooks, records, cassette tapes, children's magazines, foreign language courses, games, maps, laboratory equipment, computer programs, charts, tests, tools, flashcards, models, and on it goes. Mrs. Pride also addresses the key issues correlated with educational decline, from Keynesian economics and feminist propaganda to secular humanism and the look-say reading method. There are 4 volumes in the Big Book series, and they will soon be bundled with a CD-ROM as a single basic book of accompanied by a computer storehouse of the additional information. Mrs. Pride, who holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Electrical Engineering and a Master's degree in Computer Science, is heavily involved in the effort to bring homeschooling into the high-tech age. She has written Pride's Guide to Educational Software, which reviews some 750 educational computer programs and is developing plans to launch her own bulletin board system. Her new magazine, Practical Homeschooling, includes a high-tech section, which she speculates will eventually spin off into a magazine of all of its own. In the field, the Reverend Paul Lindstrom operates what may be the nation's largest combined private and homeschool program. He has been an activist in commendable causes for decades, first achieving national prominence in the late 1960s after North Korea captured the USS Puebla in January of 1968. He founded the Remember the Pueblo Committee to assure that Commander Lloyd M. Butcher and his crew were not flushed down the memory hole, as has so often happened with Americans held captive by the communists. Commander Butcher and his crew were released in December of 1968. There are presently some 600 students enrolled at Reverend Lindstrom's Christian Liberty Academy in Prospect Heights, Illinois. The school-affiliated Christian Liberty Press publishes about 100 titles for use in the curricula, but also utilizes material from other Christian-oriented outlets, such as Alpha Omega and Bob Jones University Press. The off-campus CLA satellite schools have some 30,000 enrollees in all 50 states and 59 foreign countries, mostly homeschools for Americans based overseas, military personnel, diplomats, missionaries, and so on, but in some instances on campus, for example, Japan, Suriname, and in Russia. The current Russian former Soviet ambassador to Suriname enrolled his daughter in the Christian Liberty Academy of Paramaribo, the capital, in the late 1980s. On one occasion, when the ambassador was called to Moscow, his daughter, who had by then completed second grade, was interviewed by Soviet authorities, who, as recalled by Reverend Lindstrom, brought up some matters that were very evolutionary in nature, and she told him, "No, that's not right. God made everything." So the handlers of the children, I guess, were taken aback by that and wondered. Well, where in the world is this girl going to school? But the father got a kick out of it, and he would tell the story, and he'd laugh. And he was so proud of his daughter, he was not upset in any way, shape, or form that she challenged the educational masters back there in Moscow who were quizzing her. He thought it was just great. Staff personnel from other embassies, including that of Red China, also send their children to the Paramaribo school, where enrollment now exceeds 300. Indeed, Reverend Lindstrom says the embassy of one Asian country has designated the school as the school of choice for any of their embassy personnel that are interested in being educated in the English language. In Russia, Reverend Lindstrom has worked with former Soviet dissidents to establish 6 on-campus schools to date, and Reverend Lindstrom's experience clearly confirms the worldwide nature of the private and homeschool phenomenon. Here are some statistics. Brian D. Ray, Ph.D., is an associate professor of science and education at Western Baptist College in Salem, Oregon. He also heads the National Home Education Research Institute, which, as the name implies, specializes in the collection, analysis, and reporting of statistical data relating to homeschooling. Such data are used to help initiate legislation related to homeschooling and family issues and to bolster the position of homeschoolers who become involved in legal process. The Institute also publishes the quarterly journal Homeschool Researcher to keep subscribers abreast of the ever-growing body of research in the area of home education. Dr. Ray, a father of six children, pegs homeschool enrollment at between 450 and 820,000 nationally. That's as of 1994, indicating an increase in recent years of between 20 and 40% annually. A nationwide study which he conducted of 1,516 families found home-educated students to be scoring on average above the 80th percentile in all areas of standardized achievement tests compared to the national public school average at the 50th percentile. Other studies have found that home educators are adequately addressing the socialization needs of their children and that the children have significantly lower problems in behavioral scores than their government school peers, and that happily, home educators and their families do not in general have a strong desire for access to tax-funded resources. Some of the most important sources of information regarding education-related issues are the books and other research materials compiled by largely unheralded individuals who stumble across or otherwise become interested in a topic and then investigate largely on their own. For example, a Pennsylvania mother and homemaker, Anita Hodge, has become one of the country's best-informed activists on education issues as a result of an ongoing investigation triggered in 1981 when her children began showing signs of emotional distress after being subjected to privacy-invading school questionnaires, death education conditioning, and other traumatic happenings. The remarkable story of Mrs. Hodge's subsequent probe was recounted in the 1991 book Education for the New World Order by Beverly Eakman. In her own recent book, A New Managed Economy, School of Tomorrow, and in an audio tape of one of her speeches, accompanied by printed documentation supporting her allegations, entitled Talking Papers. Mrs. Hodge sheds additional light on such concerns as outcome-based education and the drive to redefine the term family, the carefully orchestrated process of creating human capital, intellectually hamstrung and subservient workers conditioned to do the bidding of supposed superiors, and plans to collect, computerize, and centralize the most minute and intimate details about every American from cradle to the grave. Dennis L. Cuddy, Ph.D., has been a government school and university teacher, and from 1982 to 88 served as a senior associate with the U.S. Department of Education. Dr. Cuddy appears frequently as a guest columnist in USA Today, and is author of two books relating to education. One is The Grab for Power, a chronology of the NEA, which takes the reader through the history and influence of the nation's largest teachers' union, and A Chronology of Education with Quotable Quotes, which excerpts the speeches and writings of key insiders of the humanist education establishment. From 1981 to 1983, Charlotte Isherby was a special assistant in the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Educational Research and Improvement. Her 1985 book, Back to Basics Reform or Skinnerian International Curriculum, was among the first to expose the dangers of out-based education, the OBE program, and provide convincing evidence that federal and state governments, in collusion with social engineers in the major tax-exempt foundations, were scheming to manipulate and control Americans from birth to death using the educational system as the primary vehicle for bringing about planned social, political, and economic change. This important book was reprinted last year. Mrs. Isherby has also compiled a weighty research package, which she refers to as her 3D proof packet, entitled Deliberate Dumbdown. It contains the extensive documentation which she has compiled about the OBE program over the years. This article is from The New American, Volume 10, Number 16, August 8, 1994, What Went Wrong with the Educational System, and it's on page 59, entitled The Right Stuff. Now, that's an old article, 1994, so the problem with public education has been around for a while. People have been talking about it, but notice in the article they talked about the scheming foundations seeking to control education for what purpose? Well, if we take a look here, one of the major world arenas in which Hegelian philosophy and the materialistic anti-psychology of want has been applied is that of education. In 1819 in Prussia, the first compulsory schooling for children was instituted, according to educator John Taylor Gatto. And the society in Prussia was divided into children who will become policymakers, that's number one, children who become assistants to policymakers, that's number two, people such as engineers, architects, lawyers, and doctors. And then third, the children who will be the vast massed used in industry. Prussia sets up a three-tier school system in which one-half of 1% of the population is taught to think. They go to the school called Academie. 5.5% of the population go to the real schooling, where they partially learn to think, but not completely, because Prussia believed their defeat at the hands of Napoleon was caused by people thinking for themselves at times of stress on the battlefield. They were going to see to it that scientifically this could not happen again. Then the third group, the lowest 94%, that's some pyramid, went to Volksschulen, where they were to learn harmony, obedience, freedom from stressful thinking, and how to follow instructions. They worked out a system that would in fact guarantee such results. In the Volksschulen, it was to divide whole ideas, which really simultaneously participate in math, science, social thinking, language, and art, into subjects which hardly had existed before, to divide the subjects further into units, to divide the time into small enough units of time. With enough variations in the course of a day, no one would know what was going on. In the middle of the last century, a member of the secret Skull and Bone Society, following in the Prussian tradition, set in motion in an American educational revolution that has subverted the entire educational system in America toward the goals of the New World Order. That man was Daniel Coit Gilman. He was the first president of Johns Hopkins University and of the Carnegie Institution. Gilman studied Hegelian philosophy at the University of Berlin in 1854. Also at the University of Berlin during the same time was the earlier mentioned Wilhelm Wundt, who was key in applying Hegelian-styled psychology to the world. Gilman came from a family of bonesmen, and after he returned from Germany in 1856, he became the treasurer of Skull and Bones. Now, simultaneously, Gilman became assistant librarian at Yale University, and he was appointed to the position of head librarian 2 years later. Now, during the same period, Skull and Bones covertly took over the administration of the entire Yale University academic staff, and with the presidency of the school from that period forward, and turned over to a succession of Illuminized Bonesmen from that day forward. That comes from the Iconoclast, October 13, 1873. They have obtained control of Yale. Its business is performed by them. Money that is paid to the college must pass into their hands and be subject to their will. No doubt they are worthy men in themselves, but the many whom they look down upon while in college cannot so far forget as to give money freely into their hands. Men in Wall Street complain that the college comes straight to them for help instead of asking each graduate for his share. The reason is found in a remark made by one of Yale's and America's first men. He said, quote, "Few will give, but Bones men, and they care far more for their society than they do for the college." The Woolsey Fund has but a struggling existence for kindred reasons. Here then appears the true reason for Yale's poverty. Yale is controlled by a few men who shut themselves off from all of the others and assume to be their superiors. Well, Gilman met with Frederick T. Gates, who ran Rockefeller's foundations, and he implored him to set up the Southern Educational Board, merging the Slater and Peabody funds. Gilman called the foundation the General Education Board, signaling his intentions. The organization was later renamed the Rockefeller Foundation. Gilman was the first president of Johns Hopkins University, and he carefully chose for the faculty members from the Skull and Bones and other groups of the Hegelian stripe, and among those was G. Stanley Hall, the first of once American students. Hall's training in Leipzig was paid for by a loan from a member of Scroll and Key, sister society to Skull and Bones at Yale. In Leipzig, Hall immersed himself in Hegelian-inspired psychological studies, taught by materialist psychologists like Hartmann, Helmholtz, and his greatest influence, Wundt. Returning to America in 1883, he took over the psychological laboratory at the new Johns Hopkins University and started the American Psychological Association and the American Journal of Psychology. And according to Hall, the psychology I taught was almost entirely experimental and covered for the most part the material that Wundt had set forth in the latter and larger edition of Psychological Psychology. In 1889, Hall was chosen as the first president of the newly established Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. Hall was the mentor of one of the most influential names in American education in this century. His name, John Dewey. Dewey studied under Hall at Johns Hopkins, moving on to teach at the universities of Michigan and Minnesota. Another major influence upon Dewey was the Hegelian philosopher George Sylvester Morris, who had received his doctorate from the University of Berlin. According to Dewey, echoing the sentiments of his Prussian mentors, "There is no God, there is no soul, there are no needs for the props of traditional religion. With dogma and creed excluded, then immutable truth is also dead and buried. There is no room for fixed natural law or permanent moral absolutes." Now, those are the Moores, and it is the basis of public school education and the National Education Association. If you want your child to be educated in that kind of an environment, you cannot go to a better source than the public school. They have it all. Now, back in 1895, to give you a little illustration as to how the public schools have degenerated over the years. An eighth grade test in 1895. Could you have passed the eighth grade back in 1895? Remember when grandparents and great-grandparents stated that they only had an eighth grade education? Well, check this out. This is the eighth grade final exam from 1895 in Salina, Kansas. It was taken from the original document on file, the Smoky Valley Genealogical Society and Library in Salina, Kansas, and reprinted by the Salina journal. In the eighth grade, final exam, grammar, it asks, give 9 rules for the use of capital letters. 2. Name the parts of speech and define those that have no modifications. 3. Define verse, stanza, and paragraph. 4. What are the principal parts of a verb? Give the principal parts of a lie, play, and run. Define case and illustrate each case. 6. What is punctuation? Give rules for principal marks of punctuation. And then 7 through 10, write a composition of 150 words and show therein that you understand the practical use of the rules of grammar. In arithmetic, time, 1 hour and 15 minutes. First, name and define the fundamental rules of arithmetic. 2. A wagon box is 2 feet deep, 10 feet long, 3 feet wide. How many bushels of wheat will it hold? 3. If a load of wheat weighs 3,942 pounds, what is its value at 50 cents a bushel, deducting 1,050 pounds for tare? 4. District number 33 has a valuation of $35,000. What is the necessary tax levy to carry on a school 7 months at $50 per month and have $104 for incidentals? 5. Find the cost of 6,720 pounds of coal at $6 per ton. 6. Find the interest of $512.60 for 8 months and 18 days at 7%. 7. What is the cost of 40 boards 12 inches wide, 16 feet long at $20 per board foot? 8. Find a bank discount on $300 for 90 days, no grace at 10%. 9. What is the cost of a square farm at $15 per acre, the distance of which is 640 rods? 10. Write a bank check, a promissory note, and a receipt. Now that's just the first two parts of the test, boys and girls. They also have U.S. history, geography, and orthography. Time 1 hour. Time is 1 hour. Can you tell me what orthography is? I didn't know either. Now that's a eighth grade school test of 1895. I would submit to you that most college graduates today could not pass that test. Hey, we're running out of time. I got to give you a final reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And good night, friends.